So you know the other thing, one thing I always want to ask Marjorie Taylor Greene, you know, never, no one ever asked her this.
What's
the
that?
Classic question. You said to Marjorie Taylor Greene, did Joe Biden win Georgia? Did he win Georgia? No, he didn't. So you're not a congresswoman then, because you were elected on the same ballot paper. I'm willing to concede that he's not president if you concede you're not a member of Congress.
Well, I don't know about you, but I sure as hell wouldn't want to debate him. My guest today is a journalist, anchor, and interviewer who has clashed with politicians, generals, spy chiefs, and celebrities from across the world. Mehdi Hasan is the host of The Mehdi Hasan Show on MSNBC and the New York Times bestselling author of Win Every Argument, The Art of Debating, Persuading, and Public Speaking. We're going to get into, I'm going to avoid the debating part as much as possible, but we will definitely do the persuading and the public speaking. I'm looking forward to having this conversation with Mehdi Hasan here on the Michael Steele Podcast, coming up next, right after this. Hey, everybody, welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. And as I mentioned, I'm really excited to have this conversation today with Mehdi because this brother just brings the A game in everything he does. And one area in particular, as I mentioned to him, I wouldn't want to debate him. Mehdi, welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast.
Thank you for having me. Michael, of all the people to say that, you're not one of the people to say that.
No, I've seen
you on the airwaves. I've seen you with conservatives, with Democrats, with liberals. I've seen you. You don't hold back.
Dude, you just bring, you have a way, and it's a combination of a debating style as well as a journalistic approach to the conversation. In your book, Win Every Argument, The Art of Debating, what are some of the things that you were sort of developing that craft, that ability? What did you learn that made you think, Let me go this way. Let me do that. Let me make this turn. Was it just getting? I mean, the easy thing is like I'm talking to these people, these idiots who have no idea what they're talking about, which is an easy one. But when you came up against someone who presented a real challenge, yes. What goes through your head as you're trying to dissect your next question, your next move to really get to the nub of what you want people to hear?
It's a great question, Michael. I mean, the answer is not actually rocket science. The answer is be prepared, be prepared, be prepared. And you can never be too prepared. And I mean, people think, oh, that's, you know, the department of bleeding obvious. It is bleeding obvious. And yet people still aren't prepared. I mean, you and I have seen people go on TV and, you know, crash and burn. And I just think, not just TV, you know, in your boardroom, in courtroom, in school, we've seen it happen across the country, across the world. And it amazes me, what annoys me as someone who does this for a living, as a TV anchor, as someone who enjoys to debate, as someone who's been a pundit, what frustrates me is people think they can cut corners, or they think when it comes to public speaking, it's something you just do. And the example I give is, you know, we wouldn't... A surgeon getting ready to cut you open on the operating table. We trust that they've been, you know, they've practiced, they've done the medical degree, they've read the journals, they've, you know, they're taking it seriously. The accountant who's doing your tax returns, you're not just giving it to any person. You're looking at the guy who knows what they're doing. But for some reason, when it comes to public speaking, when it comes to interviewing, when it comes to debating, we think, oh yeah, anyone can do that. We could just wing that. There's no need to prep. No need to prep. And I'm like, no, the reason I wrote the book is actually the stuff can be taught, should be taught, should be learned. And it goes back thousands of years. You know, when people like Aristotle are writing Rhetoric, his landmark work over 2000 years ago, which I cite a lot from in the book, you know, Aristotle is saying, hey, here are the strategies, here are the skills, and they stay with us for millennia. And I'm thinking to myself, why are people not looking? The stuff's all ready to go. I mean, I don't claim to be some original person with this book. I say in the book, I'm building on people who have come before me. Yeah, I'm bringing my own insights, anecdotes, experiences. But the framework, you know, I'm quoting Aristotle, I'm quoting Demosthenes, I'm quoting Churchill and MLK. This stuff has been done. It's out there. And I don't know if it's laziness, arrogance, insecurity that makes too many people just be willing to stand up and wing it. And I say, do not wing it. Never wing it.
Yeah, you never wing it. And you talk about this in the book, and I think this would be a good jump off point in this conversation. The difference between a conversation and a debate. Because when you're on TV doing your thing, on the Mehdi Hassan show. I'm on TV doing my thing as a talking head. You're at once engaged in a conversation.
Yeah.
But then you also, you know, depending on who you're talking with, could sort of slide into a little bit of a debate.
Yeah.
How do you see that? And talk to me about some of the differences between those two styles.
Not just those two styles, multiple styles, Michael. I mean, what I say in the book and what I say in every interview that I do about the book is context matters. Everything comes back to context. People say, well, hold on. You know, the arguments that you use to convince your crazy uncle at the Thanksgiving table are not the same arguments you use to win over a crowd in a university auditorium or to win over a TV audience in primetime on cable. Yes.
Right.
Exactly my point. You've got to be flexible. You've got to adapt. You know, Yasser Arafat, the former Palestinian leader, a lot of Israelis used to slam him with this line, Michael, that he speaks in two tongues. He says in Arabic something, and then he says something different in English. Now, whether that's true or not, an argument for another day. But the point being is, like I say in the book, there's nothing wrong with speaking to different audiences in different ways. It's not dishonest. I'm not telling you to be right wing in front of one crowd, left wing in front of another. I'm saying be able to tailor your message to who's in front of you and what you're trying to achieve. Are you trying to rhetorically defeat an opponent who you dislike or disagree with, or are trying to beat in a formal competition? That requires a different style. To are you trying to convince your uncle at the Thanksgiving table who's saying crazy stuff about microchips and vaccines, but you love crazy Uncle Tom? You don't want to attack him personally. You want to win him over. So it's a different style. It's a different approach. And you can use different rhetorical strategies in different ways, depending on where you are. So in the book, I try and lay out, here's what you do if you're in a formal debate. You're in a high school debate. You're being graded by a judge. But here's what you do if you're with a friend who you want to really get through to, or if you're with an audience of strangers. You know, I've stood in front of audiences where, this audience, they don't like me. They don't come from where I come from. They have a different set of politics. But I still have to try and get through to them. What do I do? So you really have to adapt your message, your tone, your style, your content, based on who's in front of you. And the reason I start the book, the 16 chapters, chapter one is know your audience. That is key. If you don't understand who you're targeting your appeal, who you're appealing to, who you're trying to persuade, who you're trying to convince, then you've lost before, you know, you've got out of the starting gate.
That last point is so damned important. It is amazing to me the number of times that people, particularly politicians, get in front of an audience and don't know who they're speaking to.
Yeah.
I recall when I was a young county chairman, I had a candidate that was running for Congress in the 4th Congressional District here in Prince George's County, Maryland. And I went to one of his little town hall that he did. And he got up, nice little conservative chap. He stood up in front of this office audience, again, Prince George's County, Maryland. At that time, the largest, wealthiest Black county in the United States. And he goes up and he starts laying out the fundamentals of what he wanted to do when he got to Congress. He wanted to, lower taxes. He wanted to, invigorate entrepreneurs. And as he said to the audience, I want to, I'm going to go there and reduce the size of government, smaller government, He went through the whole thing. So after his little town hall, I got up and I went up to him. I said, that was really good. But I just have one question. Who were you talking to? Mm-hmm. And he looked at me and he goes, I was talking to the women and women and men in the audience. I said, well, but who was your audience? And so I had to help him. I said, your audience was primarily comprised of middle-class African-American federal government employees. So when you said to them, send me to Congress so I can reduce the size of government,
yes,
what do you think they heard?
Yeah.
And he paused. I said, you just told all of them you want to fire them.
Yeah.
And so it really does matter, an understanding fundamentally of your audience. And this is one thing that I will give Trump credit for. He knows his audience. He knows how to speak to that audience. He knows how to move that audience with his rhetoric. His presentation sucks. His reading skills are atrocious. His ability to just fundamentally communicate are suspect. But he knows his audience. And somehow he's able to get to work.
I'm gonna half agree with you. He definitely knows his audience at his rallies. He knows how to win over GOP. He knows how to win over GOP base. But you'll remember, Michael, if you remember the first presidential debate in 2020, you remember that car crash where he's shouting and talking over Biden and Chris Wallace. Yes. That's his audience that night was not the base. His audience that night was independent swing voters, people he needs to win over who are very skeptical of Trump. And he plays. The problem with Trump is once he's won over his audience, he doesn't want to broaden the appeal. The fundamental problem with the GOP right now, as even Nikki Haley pointed out in her opening speech for running for president, haven't won the popular vote for 7 of the last 8 presidential elections. You need to be able to expand the electorate, and Trump is not the guy who's interested in expanding electorate. You know, he talks about my people. The worst thing you can talk about when you're running for national office nationwide. Like I talk about in the book about how there was a time when I was on a BBC panel in England, in a small rural town in southern England. It's an all-white, elderly Daily Mail reading crowd. I'm on a panel, and I'm one of only 2 people in the entire room who's under the age of 40 at the time. And they asked me a question about deporting an alleged terrorist to the Middle East, and the crowd all want to do it. I'm like, how do I, what do I say to this crowd? If I quote Human Rights Watch or Amnesty, they don't care. I quote, the European Convention on Human Rights, they don't care. What do I do? How do I connect with this crowd? So what do? I have to identify with that crowd. I'm a brown lefty on the panel. They're a white, small C conservative crowd. What do I say? I say, let's talk Magna Carta. Let's talk the British Constitution of 1215. What do we as a country stand for? We stand for habeas corpus. We stand for no detention without trial. We stand against torture. And the crowd applauded me, even though moments earlier they'd been completely against me. Why? Because I knew there's no point. I can't make them more hostile than they already are. Right. I have to find common ground. Yeah, we disagree on everything else, but we're all proud Britons who believe in the history of liberty.
So that actually speaks to how you open the book. You start talking about feelings, not just facts. And reading through that, you kind of get this sense that a lot of times people, it's almost like a competition between feelings and facts. And people just feel they have to, I got to overwhelm them with the facts. And you see this a lot with a lot of my friends on the left in sort of dealing with MAGA or Republicans, even back in the day when Republicans were normal. They kind of would lead a little bit more into the heavy part with, the feelings and, poor this, we got to deal with that. And Republicans on the reverse would like, but here's the bottom line. This is how much GDP is growing. This is what happens if you raise the minimum wage. And that people seem to get lost in translating the difference between feelings and facts and understanding that what you just noted there is a good example of understanding A, your audience, and B,
how to connect emotion.
Less about the facts, because you will likely be right on the facts.
Yeah, you got to be right on the facts, but facts alone are not enough. Right. And if you think you're going to persuade people just here, you've lost. You have to persuade them in your heart, not just your head. And if it's heart versus head, the heart wins. And again, to come back to our friend, Mr. Trump, he gets this, right? He knows how to rile up his base emotionally. Right. He is a demagogue. He does it in the worst possible way. He riles up the worst possible emotions, our darkest side, our fear, our loathing, our victimhood, our grievances, our paranoia, our hatred of the foreigner and the other. But he does it very well. And up against a message in 2016, for example, that was build a wall, lock her up, ban Muslims. Very, very emotive, demagogic messages. Hillary Clinton comes along and says, here's my 16-point childcare plan.
Right.
That just is not going to work. Like, I'm sure Hillary Clinton's childcare plan was amazing and would have helped parents in this country. But that is not what's going to get people to the voting booth. And Democrats for far too long have not understood this very obvious point. People do not vote based on policy. That we are not kind of super rational, cold-blooded calculators who step into the voting booth and say, well, the Democratic candidate is going to raise GDP by 6.2%, the Republican candidate by 6.1%, therefore I will vote Democrat. No, they go in and they say, oh, George Bush is the kind of guy I want to have a barbecue with, Al Gore, not so much. Donald Trump's the kind of guy who wants to tear down the corruption in DC. Hillary Clinton, she's very cold and, just talks in wonky numbers. Like, unfortunately, I wish the world wasn't that way, but we have to live in the world as it is, not as the world as we want it to be. We are not filled with people just deploying the Socratic method. We're filled with warm-blooded, emotionally, Dale Carnegie, I quote him in the book, human beings are not creatures of logic. We are creatures of emotion. Therefore, if we're going to persuade them, we have to have emotive arguments. And another example I give in the book, you said, when Republicans were normal. I mean, George Bush Sr. in 1988 is up against Michael Dukakis. That Bernard Shaw of CNN asks Dukakis, would you still support the death penalty if Kitty Dukakis, your wife, were raped and murdered? The crowd, what a question. And Dukakis gives a long, rambling, boring answer about how he would cut drug crime and what Massachusetts crime levels are. And everyone's wondering, the guy just said your wife was raped and killed. Where is some emotion, man? Like, where is, you should be mad. They wanted to see their commander-in-chief's gut reaction, and he didn't show any emotion. And his campaign manager that night said, the moment he said that, I knew we'd lost.
Well, that's that you I was just pulling up some of the sort of tools of the trade you're talking about in the book. You note, for example, you know, when we talk about know your audience and all of that, but tell a story, choose your words wisely. The other piece was show, don't just tell.
Which Dukakis didn't. He was flat. He was a robot. No sign of emotion on his face or in his body language. Exactly. I mean, a lot of what we do to persuade people comes from our eyes, from our face, from our body language. I quote Tony Montana in the book, you know, Scarface. Yes. It's the eyes, Chico. They never lie. Like, people are looking, they're not just hearing your voice. They're not just listening to the facts and figures. They are evaluating you as a person, as a messenger, as a communicator. They bond not just with your argument, but with you personally.
So you have in the book, this chapter, you ask the question at the top, how did the wholly unqualified Donald J. Trump, a former reality TV star and failed property developer, defeat 16 Republican rivals in the race for the 2016 GOP presidential nomination? How did he do it?
I mean, there are many answers in that chapter. You're quoting from the chapter, which is called Play the Man and the Ball, not just the ball. Right. And that's a chapter on ad hominem attacks. And I'm referring there to the way in which Donald Trump was able to kind of deflate and undermine his many opponents with kind of crude nicknames, which, you know, all of us openly would say, oh, that's so immature and childish. But deep down, we're thinking, actually, that kind of works. I mean, we don't want to admit it, but, you know, low energy Bush, low energy Jeb. Yeah, Lion Ted, Little Marco, these things stick. I mean, Trump has very few skills in life, but, you know, he's the schoolyard bully who's very good at nicknaming people. Let's see how far Meatball Ron and Ron DeSantimonious go. Not so great. But my point in that chapter is not to say we should be like Trump and just verbally abuse people and give people nicknames, but I'm making a broader point about the fact that, going back to Aristotle, ethos is a part of our appeal. It's not just pathos, emotion, which we talked about, or logos, the facts and the figures. Ethos matters too, your personal credibility. People don't just decide on an argument. If two people are making a case for and against, they don't just decide the audience based on some abstract idea of what's right and wrong. They also look at who's making the argument. Do I trust that person? Right. Do I like that person? Are they qualified to speak on this topic? And that's totally fine. That makes sense. So I say in the book, look, don't run away from ad hominem attacks. We're told these, you can't go ad hom. It means you've lost the argument if you go ad hom. No, not necessarily. There are certain types of ad hominem attacks which are relevant. And I define three in the book. I say, for example, the abusive ad hominem, not, you know, oh, you're fat or ugly. No.
Right.
But if somebody lies, for example, if you're on a debate stage with Donald Trump, of course you should tell the audience he's a liar and that they shouldn't trust him. He has a history of deceit. Yeah, don't trust this guy. He has a history of lying. That's, of course, it's a dereliction of duty not to do that. Similarly, if you're on a debate stage with somebody who's saying, you know what, climate change, it's all a myth, and he's paid by ExxonMobil, the circumstantial ad hominem, pointing out that conflict of interest, the circumstances, is also very relevant. And the third type of ad hominem I talk about is the tu quoque, the hypocrisy argument, the Republican politician who says, we should ban all abortions, no exceptions, race, rape and incest, but he has an exception for his mistress. Well, I think it's relevant to bring that up. Now, you might say, well, that's an unfair personal attack. It doesn't actually affect, you know, the actual substance of the argument about abortion and viability and fetal pain. I get that. That's true.
It goes to credibility, though.
But it goes to, not just credibility, it goes to the idea of, this person wants you to agree with their principles they can't seem to live by. So maybe there's something tricky about those principles. Maybe we need to scrutinize this further. And people say, well, ad hominem attack is a logical fallacy. And in logical terms, it is. But my book's about rhetoric. It's about communication. And in the world of communications, you want your audience to trust you and not your opponent.
So You set that up, but then I love it. And this is what you just, okay, so let me share with you the other side. Beware the counterattack, right?
Oh, yeah.
And you tell the story of your appearance on Question Time, that the Daily Mail would come after me, for it was inevitable. It was the Daily Mail, after all. Sure enough, the very next day, the paper leaked an extract of a letter that I'd written to them 3 years earlier, asking for an opportunity to write in the Mail. Look, Hasan the hypocrite. So what?
It's a risky strategy.
It's a risky strategy.
It's a high reward, high risk strategy. If you get the ad hom right, you can completely put your opponent on the ropes. You can destroy their credibility, but then they come after you. And this has happened to me all the time. It happened to me right now. So this, it goes with the territory. So I wouldn't advise everyone to go down the ad hom road, but if you feel it's relevant, go for it. But then realize that if you're able to attack your opponent's credibility, they have the right to attack yours.
So that it leads to an interesting conversation that it really doesn't in one sense prove the point we're talking about, but it is an example of where you go on the offensive in a good way, saying, hey, let's have this conversation. The person engages you and then all hell breaks loose. And I'm referring to you and Matt Taibbi. And that whole episode, which played out over several Twitter exchanges, and tell us about that and how that is an example of some of the things you're talking about in the book. Attack, counterattack, the ability to have your act together, know your facts. Because to me, it didn't seem that Matt came prepared to have the conversation with you, even though he would have challenged you, right?
I suspect he would have done well if he'd actually read the book, because the book points out, the importance of preparation, the importance of showing your receipts. I mean, look, me and my team, we did our homework on that interview. A lot of people have tried to turn that interview into something else. This is the interview I did on the Mehdi Hasan show a few weeks ago on Peacock about the Twitter files, which Matt and others reported on. And, there's now a counter narrative amongst his supporters, which says, I just went ad hominem on him, which ironically I didn't. I mean, I did.
No, you did.
We talk very much about substance. Now, they don't like the substance. They say these were only minor details and minor errors. Fine, each to their own. We can debate that all day long, how minor or major they are. But my team and I did a lot of research. And, Michael, you've guest hosted my show. How good my team is. I mean, these are great people who really dig deep. Now I'm doing a weekly show. I miss doing my nightly show. But the advantage of a weekly show is you have way more time to prepare. And as I said at the start of the interview, I love to prepare. So we dig deep. We go through all the tweets. We go through all the articles that are written. We check, for contradictions, inconsistencies, etc. And don't forget, I didn't invite Matt Taibbi on the show. He invited himself on the show.
No, that's right.
And also, he invited himself on the show very specifically to talk about Twitter working with the Indian far-right government to censor tweets, which he's never commented on. And when I challenged him, he said, well, invite me on your show and I'll tell you my views. And when I asked him on the show, he acted like he'd never heard of India or Twitter, or that he hadn't invited himself on the show. I have no idea what was going on there. He had 2 weeks to prepare an answer, but didn't have one. And still, as far as I know, hasn't given an answer what he thinks about Musk. We did our homework. I don't think it was ad hominem to point out errors in people's articles. As I say, I'm not someone who runs away from an ad hominem argument, but in that case, we didn't go ad hominem. I didn't bring up Matt Taibbi's past. There's a lot of people who go into his past. He hasn't got the greatest of pasts. He keeps going after my past. But we didn't do that. We stuck to his reporting on the Twitter files, pointed out what we thought were errors and inconsistencies and contradictions. And then we talked about Elon Musk, which he didn't want to talk about because he's a fan of Elon Musk. And then the very next day, he fell out with Elon Musk. And never has there been a more interesting timed interview. I was thinking about the timing of that interview. We did it on the Thursday. On the Friday, he quits Twitter, although he's back on Twitter to attack me, funnily enough, with ad homs. But he quit Twitter the next day. And then by Saturday, Elon Musk was calling Taibbi a liar. Trouble in paradise, as they say. But that interview we're proud of such interviews because what I'm known for is bringing receipts, is doing homework, is asking follow-up questions. One of the things I say in the book, there's a whole chapter on how to deal with Trump and mini Trumps who kind of gish gallop and BS and try and overwhelm you with lies. And one of the few things you can do is you got to be prepared. You got to be ready not to budge. You got to be ready to have your receipts.
What is the gish gallop and how does Trump employ it? Because I was going to raise that to you. Yeah.
So the gish gallop is a phrase that's known in debate circles, but it actually comes from the world of creationism. So back in the 1990s and 80s, and you can see these on YouTube, there were a lot of debates between Christian evangelical creationists, the people who say the world was created literally in 8 days, there is no evolution, that's all a conspiracy, and scientists, evolutionary biologists. They have these big debates, right, and big auditoriums. And Dwayne Gish, the late Dwayne Gish, was a famous creationist who debated these scientists, and he beat them. Even though these scientists were more credentialed, more qualified, knew the science better, he would run rings around them. And the way he ran rings around them was he would turn up and he would throw a blizzard of cherry-pick statistics, out-of-context quotes, debunked studies, one after another, but not give you enough time to rebut. The scientists, most scientists are not great public speakers, are not trained in the art of debate. They come, you know, for a good faith discussion about some peer-reviewed paper, and this guy is throwing 20, 30, 40 accusations at them. And the audience, the independent audience who's, you know, hasn't taken a side, they think, well, hold on, the scientist hasn't rebutted everything that Dwayne Gish said, so maybe Dwayne Gish has got a point. And Trump has borrowed this technique. It's called the Gish Gallop, where you overwhelm your opponent in a limited time setting, maybe a presidential debate, maybe a TV interview, and you throw so much crap against the wall. And A, you see what sticks, but B, your opponent just doesn't have the time, energy, or ability to rebut it all. And I give the example in the book of that 2020 first presidential debate, right, where Trump, I think, was producing a lie every 3 or 4 seconds, where Chris Wallace couldn't cut him off. And, you know, there's no way Joe Biden or Chris Wallace could stop and rebut every single one of the 20 nonsensical statements that Trump had made. And that's what the Gish Galloper relies on. He relies on the idea that you won't be able to rebut everything, and therefore the audience will be disoriented, confused. And what I say in the book is there is a way you can stop that. It's not easy. That's why Trump does it. Which is, number one, pick your battle. Don't try and rebut everything. Pick the weakest, most ridiculous, dumbest thing your opponent said and go after that one. Number two, don't budge. The Gish Galloper wants the interviewer to say, well, time's up, or I got to go to a break, or next question, let's change something. No, don't budge. What I say when I have Trump supporters on my show, I don't these days because I don't like election deniers on my show. But back in the day, I've interviewed Trump people, and I say to them, look, we're not budging. We're not moving from this topic. I know you want to talk about something else. I want to answer to this question. And number three is call it out. Make it clear to your audience what's going on here. Talk about what a Gish Gallop is. Talk about, you know, the Putin strategy, the fire hose of falsehood, which is the RAND Corporation's description of what the Russians do in terms of misinformation, right? You have to make it clear to the audience, this is not a good faith person. And what they're saying is not reasonable, rational, or logical. They're trying to, what's the phrase that Steve Bannon used? Flood the zone with shit.
That's it. That's it. Flood the zone with shit. And it really kind of then begs the question of how that translates out into the broader communication ether. So when you look at platforms like social media, Twitter, et cetera, how do you see those changing the nature of debate and conversation in this country? The Gish Gallop is a good example of that, where, you know, you just sort of flood the zone with all of this crap. And I see it on Twitter a lot. People, you take, you know, Mehdi puts out a very fine point on an issue, and then you look at the comments beneath, and you can see the rabbit hole.
Yes.
You can see folks just starting to just go, and you're like, wait a minute, you're raising something that has nothing to do with the point that was first established in the original tweet.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say two things. Number one, if I rewrote the book, if I wrote a sequel to the book, I would write a chapter about how to argue on social media, because it's not easy. And there's a whole different set of, there are some different things you need to do on social media, but there's some common themes too. So for example, show your receipts. That's something I try and do on Twitter a lot.
Right.
When I quote tweet or dunk tweet or do whatever you want to do, I always have a link. I say, hey, here it is. Here's the evidence. You say this, but what about this? You know, that's always very important to have the link, to show your work, to have your evidence. Bring your receipts, to quote the great, late, great Whitney Houston. And I think the other point that still is a common theme from the book, but also works on social media, which is in the Gish Gallop chat, is don't budge. Like, you know, one thing I do is, I keep coming back. So there's a guy who works for Ron DeSantis called Jeremy Redfern. He's the deputy press secretary, taxpayer funded. But all he does is troll people, you know, fight culture wars. You know, DeSantis' team, they don't actually deal with Floridians or press complaints. They're just busy fighting culture wars online. And Redfern's a classic, always comes after me on some nonsense. And I always say to Jeremy Redfern, hey, do you remember when Nick Fuentes had dinner with Donald Trump in your state? How come DeSantis never said anything?
Never did.
Redfern will say, what about Rashida Tlaib? What about Ilhan Omar? What about, okay, great. Thanks for all that. How come Ron DeSantis has never said anything about Nick Friedman? And 1 month later, Jeremy Riffle comes to troll me. Why am I at the World Cup not in a mask? I'm in an outdoor stadium, whatever. But then I go, hey, has Ron DeSantis commented on Nick Friedman? Don't budge. I every month, I'll do it for the rest of my life. Because he doesn't want to answer that question. He wants to talk about everything but that. You don't budge. Don't play that game.
That is so true. He does not, has not, and will not. He will not.
But sometimes, and I say this as an interviewer, there is value in just asking the question.
There is so true. It is so true. The book is Win Every Argument, The Art of Debating, Persuading, and Public Speaking. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to apply this book to our current state of politics. Right after this, more with Mehdi Hasan right after this.
Hey, folks, this is Charlie Sykes, host of the Bulwark podcast and friend of the Michael Steele Show. We created the Bulwark to provide a platform for pro-democracy voices on the center-right and the center-left, for people who are tired of tribalism and who value truth and vigorous yet civil debate about politics and a lot more. And every day, we remind you folks, you are not the crazy ones. On my daily podcast, and that's right, we do it five times a week, I'm joined by some of the smartest, savviest, most provocative voices on the scene, and every day, we have great conversations. You won't always agree, but you won't be disappointed. So why not head over to thebulwark.com and take a look around? Every day, we produce newsletters and podcasts that will help you make sense of our politics and keep your sanity intact. To get a daily dose of sanity in your inbox, why not try a Bulwark Plus membership free for the next 30 days? To claim this offer, go to thebulwark.com/Charlie. That's thebulwark.com/Charlie. We're going to get through this together. I promise.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Michael Steele podcast. I'm Michael Steele and having a great conversation. A lot of fun with my brother here, Mehdi Hasan, a colleague and friend at MSNBC. But right now, we're focusing on his best-selling book, Win Every Argument, The Art of Debating, Persuading, and Public Speaking. There are so many lessons that we can take from your book and apply to our politics today, from everything to how candidates communicate to TikTok and the impact that it has as a source, an influencer, if you will, a system that sort of takes communication to a whole nother level. How do you, when you're looking at this environment, we talked a little bit about social media before the break. When you're looking at this environment more broadly and you're seeing and hearing these conversations out there, what's your general takeaway about how we communicate in this country, generally speaking? Is it less fact-based? Is it more emotional? Because everyone's not involved in professional debating, right? Yeah. So we're not doing this as part, you know, as someone like yourself or even, you know, myself have done. We're just communicating. How do you see that playing itself out? And how does that inform people about events and situations around them?
Yeah, it's a great question. And when I wrote the book, I did want to make it for a lay audience, you know, lay people, not just people who are working in, you know, courtrooms or on TV or in politics. And, you know, yeah, we're not having good conversations in America right now. We are not, you know, we're not listening. And there's a chapter in the book on the importance of listening.
Yes.
And when I said to my wife I was writing a chapter on the importance of listening, she kind of laughed out loud. And then she paused and she stared at me. She said, "You're writing a chapter on listening?" Because I'm not a great listener, I admit that. So that's why I had to kind of write a chapter about it. Say, look, I'm not good at it either, but we have to try to be better listeners. Because if you're not a better listener, you'll never be a better speaker.
Can I say real quick, Mehdi, to your wife's point? My mother told me when I was about 14, 15 years old, she saw me in a room and, you know, with a bunch of friends at some event. And she pulled me up later afterwards. She says, "You know what your problem is? You don't shut up and listen." And I have right now in front of me her quote, "Shut up and listen." So your point about listening is so important because it feeds and informs everything else.
And we've become worse listeners. We think we're good listeners, most of it, but we're not. And, you know, one thing I tried to say honestly in the book is, look, I'm not good at this. It's one of my weak spots. But it's important from a cynical, self-serving point of view. For example, if you are in a competitive debate, if you are trying to defeat an opponent, you need to be a critical listener. You need to be able to listen out for something they've said that's wrong or incorrect, something you can jump and pounce on. But also, not just from a cynical perspective, but from a moral perspective, empathetic listening is very important. To be able to put your shoes in the, to put yourself in the shoes of another person, to understand what they're going through, to understand what they're feeling when they're speaking. That makes the conversation just so much better. If both people are showing respect for one another, showing they're fully present, showing we're not on our phone, something I do a lot. You know, we get distracted by the shiny devices in our pockets that are calling out for our attention. You know, a lot of us, we think we're listening, but we're really just scrolling through Instagram or Twitter. It's offensive. It makes an audience think you don't value them. It makes somebody else on the other side think you're not paying attention. We think we're listening, but really we're just waiting for our turn to speak, which is always a mistake on multiple levels. So I think as a country, we really need to work on our listening skills, both across the political divide, both within our tribes. But yeah, I think, you know, we're not having great conversations. I think schools, university settings could be a better place for raising our ability to communicate. You know, my daughter does high school debate. You know, it's great in its own way, but I would like to see much more in the classroom about the importance of public speaking, building people's confidence. One of the main reasons people don't debate, don't argue, don't speak up is because they lack confidence, right? Yeah. And I have a whole chapter in the book on the importance of building confidence. Again, people are not just born confident. It's something you work on. It's something you develop like a muscle. You have to really work on it. All of us have had moments where we lack confidence, me, myself included, on live TV, nervous, sweating. What are we going to say?
Yeah.
And I think that's another important part. You know, people want to have good conversations. You need to be confident enough in your own position, your own beliefs, and in your own ability to speak. And, you know, I don't mention this this line in the book, but it's one of my favorite lines from Jerry Seinfeld, which is, you know, the polling that shows that Americans regard public speaking as their number one fear. Right. That's what the poll showed. The poll showed. So number one fear is public speaking. Number two is dying. Right. So Seinfeld has this line. He says that means that if you're at a funeral, you'd rather be in the casket than giving the eulogy. Right. That for me sums up, you know, the American public, the British public, the French public. And I think, look, let's work on that. Let's work on our ability to be able to stand in front of start. I say in the book, start small, start at dinner table, start with your family, start with a group of five. If you're nervous about speaking, try it on four or five people. Build your way up, 20, 30 people, you know, best man speech, then get, you know, auditorium, live TV, whatever it is, whatever walk of life, boardroom with your colleagues. You know, we really got to work on that. We really got to work on our confidence.
So why does it seem, you just mentioned British, why does it seem, at least from the perspective of a lot of Americans, that if a British bloke says something, you're more apt to believe it than if is it the accent? I mean, what is it?
Is it the accent? Yeah, I don't know. When I moved to the US a few years ago, my older daughter was 7-8 years old, and she was nervous about going to school. And a friend of mine, an American friend of mine, said to her, "Don't worry. You could say tomorrow morning in class that 2 + 2 = 5. Everyone will believe you because of your accent."
Right. Right?
So there is that British advantage. Although, you know, Piers Morgan didn't help those of us who came to work in the media, having been the kind of trailblazer before us. I would say, look, I mean, I think British politicians, if you look at, you know, your Boris Johnson, your David Cameron, there is a certain confidence that comes from, especially from private school educated British politician. I say that as someone who went to private school and Oxford. I went through that, you know, that process, and I've seen how that builds confidence, some would say slash arrogance. You see that in the people who've had the private school education and the college education in the UK. I get that. But it's interesting that I would argue the reverse, Michael. I would say the Americans as a whole generally are actually more confident speakers than the British public as a whole, who are far more uptight, you know, more likely on the underground, on the metro, to not want to strike up a conversation, or in a store. You know, when I started coming to America 25 years ago, it always stunned me. You go into a store, I just want to go in and buy some clothes. I don't want to strike up small talk with the sales assistant. Like, hey, have a nice day. How's it going? You know, I grew up for fun watching, you know, a lot of British people watched, you know, the Ricky Lake, Jerry Springer show.
Yes.
Be like, what is that audience doing? You know, the British audience is like, oh yeah, I've got a question to ask you. The American audience is like, screaming their heads off. So I guess it depends. Again, context matters. I think in politics, yeah, maybe the British leaders are more kind of confident, articulate, authoritative. But the general public, maybe the Americans have an edge. I'm not sure. It's a good question.
Well, that's an interesting point. I can appreciate the difference there, because it you know,
more energy here.
More energy. And the style is obviously different.
Yes.
And they're, again, like I said, for a lot of Americans, they hear, you know, a Brit speaking, and you instant credibility. You're going to pay attention to what they say. And a lot of Americans, I think, when I travel to Europe, especially, are seen as much more emotional in their responses. We tend to be a little bit hyperbolic, and we can get excited very easily. Yeah. But it just really, it's fascinating to watch how we go about communicating big and small ideas, situations, and issues, and how that oftentimes, particularly when you're in a conversation where you're clearly trying to make a point, some of the things that we were talking about, you know, the receipts being prepared, confidence, all of those things play out very differently depending on your background, your experience. When you're looking at how politicians now are dealing with free speech and dealing with concerns about society, democracies, expressing views and attitudes, how do you assess that, the sort of the government role in sort of narrating or translating or changing the way we have these big debates amongst ourselves? I think, for example, TikTok. A lot of people see TikTok as, you know, hey, there's some great dancing on TikTok. Yeah. But there are other levels and conversations that TikTok is used to express openly. And of course, yeah, there are national security concerns now being raised. And the public doesn't seem to be buying a lot of that. They like this platform, yeah, for that expression. What's your take on something like that?
It's a great question. And I should declare an interest. The Mehdi Hasan show is on TikTok, and we have a lot of followers on TikTok. We do very well on TikTok. But of course, there are the kind of national security implications, and not just national security. There is the misinformation point. I know the Matt Taibbis of this world think anything, if you say the word misinformation, you're just a government censor. And look, there are legitimate questions about, should the FBI be flagging so much stuff to Twitter? Should the government be involved in kind of, the surveilling public tweets? But the reality is, I can't believe that anyone with a straight face can look at what's happened in the last few years and say there isn't a problem online with massive misinformation and democracy. Right. I just take something close to my heart, the pandemic and all the misinformation around the pandemic. I mean, how did we become a country that turned a piece of cloth on your face into one of the biggest political divides of the modern era? Right? That was done on social media. How did we turn the country anti-vax? I mean, the anti-vaxxers have won, Michael. I'm sorry to say, in many ways. If you look at the numbers right now, if you look at the numbers on boosters, right, if you look at what's happening with other childhood vaccinations, you know, a lot of red states, the anti-vaxxers won, right? I hate to say it, but they won, and they won online. And I think, look, this is the reality, is I'm all for, you know, free speech. You shouldn't censor people. But I also think we have to live in the, again, I said it a few moments ago to you, you have to live in the world as it is, not as the world as you want it to be. And in the real world, you cannot just have this kind of flippant, the best response to bad speech is good speech. Like, right, yeah, great. That works. That doesn't work in real life. You know, we all know the old adage, the lie goes halfway around the world before the truth puts its boots on. In the social media age, that's on steroids now. Yeah. It's very hard to rebut and reject misinformation when it's going at this kind of speed. Forget the whole argument about Russian bots or whatever it is. I don't care about all that stuff. Just even organically, the number of people, I know people in my own friends and family who share nonsense online, and it's very hard to convince them. Don't just forward stuff without checking it. Like, don't just, just share unverified information. Confirmation bias. You know, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. If it confirms all your priors, it's probably not correct. And, you know, this is basic stuff, which I wish we were teaching kids in school and colleges, but also older people who love being on Facebook and sharing nonsense. So I look at QAnon, for example, which is a dangerous cult, right, which is literally undermining democracy in this country. Like, it's not some abstract crazy uncle at the table talking about pedophiles. It's people attacking the Capitol, right? There were QAnon people at the front of that mob that attacked the Capitol. There are QAnon people who have launched terrorist attacks, who have carried out murders, who have killed their own families. I'm supposed to say, hey, that's fine. No one should care. Free speech. Well, I'm not willing to do that. I think that's irresponsible to say that we don't have an obligation to think through how we limit the influence of conspiracy theories and hate mongers and grifters. So I think it's naive. I think it's disingenuous to just say free speech.
And so that gets me to one of the things that really kind of rubs me raw right now with Twitter and its new ownership, in Elon Musk. in his lie to the public that this, you know, that this is all about free speech.
And
you know, just again confusing the conversation, because the free speech argument is about the government's limits on the government's ability, not a private company. So yeah, we can limit Elon Musk's Twitter in its ability to promote and push out lies.
You mean Elon Musk as the owner of Twitter can limit what he wants?
Right.
And the previous regime that they hate also. Right. What's so funny, Michael, have you seen this week that they've announced their new policy on hate speech? And it's basically, it's the old Twitter's policy on hate speech. Their position now is freedom of speech is not freedom of reach, which is literally the line that the previous Twitter administration was using. So he bought this thing for $44 billion, more than double what it's worth, against his will, because a court made him. And then he burned down all the previous policies, smeared all the previous owners, and now he's reinventing the wheel and doing exactly what they said. By the way, one point that gets lost a lot, apart from the fact that Musk is a hypocrite on free speech, you know, he's fired employees who have spoken out. He's gone after labor unions. He tried to stop a kid who was following his plane. We know all the hypocrisy. This guy's not a free speech absolutist at all. But one thing that really bothers me is he's permanently banned Alex Jones of InfoWars. I have no problem with that. I'm happy to see Alex Jones InfoWars banned. But that's not a free speech absolutism. How come Alex Jones is banned? And did you hear the reason why he's banned? Because Elon Musk says that he lost a child, very tragedy I didn't know about. He lost a child many years ago. And he says, I cannot tolerate someone like Jones who abused all those parents who lost kids at Sandy Hook, which is great. I agree with Elon Musk. But that's not free speech absolutism.
That's not free speech
absolutism. You should tolerate Alex Jones mocking parents according to your internal logic and philosophy. Oh, wait, you don't have an internal consistent logic or philosophy. You arbitrarily have banned Alex Jones because you don't like him, which is your right and your power. But let's not pretend that you are some free speech absolutist.
And certainly let's not pretend that that's exactly what free speech in the main is about, because you have that power as a private entity to make that ban stick. You can do that. So before I let you jump, and again, folks, it's a great tool, a great resource, and there's some great narratives in there and stories from Mehdi's experience about moments where he's engaged in debate with some really interesting types. And one that I want to get your thoughts on, because I'd have popcorn, I'd have a bourbon, and I just sit comfortably in my chair to watch you do that 60-minute interview with Marjorie Taylor Greene. First off, what was your take on that interview? And how would you have approached it if you got Marjorie Taylor Greene on the Mehdi Hasan show?
So it's funny that you should raise that, because some of the interviews I've done around the book, people have said to me, are there people you wouldn't debate? Are there people you wouldn't interview? And I've said that I wouldn't interview someone like Marjorie Taylor Greene. I wouldn't give her a platform, because I don't want a platform. A, I don't want a platform fascists and authoritarians. I don't think they need my platform, and I don't want to legitimize them. But separately, election deniers. I have a hygiene test on the show. I won't have election deniers on, which limits the number of Republicans I can get on, because unfortunately, the majority of them are election deniers. I had Dan Crenshaw on my show, and the first question I asked him was, do you accept Joe Biden won the election? And he said yes. And in my head, if he'd said no, I'd have ended the interview there. I wouldn't have continued it. Right? So election deniers. I don't know how long I'm going to hold on to that position, because it means I can never have any Republicans on, because they're all election deniers now, or almost all of them. You know, climate change deniers. There was a time when I would interview climate change. I wouldn't do it now. It's just not worth it.
Right.
Obviously, Holocaust deniers. You know, people. I'm not going to argue up is down, black is white, hot is cold. I don't think there's value in having bad faith arguments with bad faith people, grifters who don't even believe what they're saying. We see the Fox Dominion settlement. What did the Dominion lawsuit tell us? What we already knew, but we saw it in black and white. People like Tucker Carlson don't even believe what they're saying on air. I'd have more respect for them if they actually were hardcore Trumpists. Apparently they
hate Trump. Right.
I've never called Trump a demonic force, but Tucker Carlson has. Even I haven't called him a demon. So my point is, with some of these people, it's just not worth it. If somebody said to me, hey, we'll host a debate, you and Tucker Carlson. Is it worth amplifying these people? That's one question you have to ask yourself.
Right.
Each to their own. And I'm not criticizing those people.
And that's a fair question. And
I don't think there's a right answer, right? I don't think there's a right answer. I think the context matters.
You know, my colleague,
Harry, My colleague Ari Melber has had Matt Gaetz on, and it was a great interview. And Ari's a great interview. Would I do it? No, each to their own, right? I'm not criticizing other people who have other strategies. But just having said all that, now I'll just come back to your question. Since I said all that, the 60 Minutes interview happened. And I would be lying to you, Michael, if I didn't say that I've rehearsed in my head every question I would have done instead. Like, I watched that not with popcorn. I watched that throwing stuff at the TV in rage with the greatest respect to Leslie Stahl, who I have great respect for, been around many years, done wonderful things in her life. But that interview was a car crash. It was awful in many ways. And when Marjorie Taylor Greene is tweeting that she enjoyed it, that tells you everything about the interview. I mean, some fundamental errors. For example, and if people have watched this, she challenges her on her social media presence and the conspiracy theories. When she says, well, I never denied Sandy Hook, they throw up a post proving that she did, but Leslie doesn't have it in the interview. There's no point throwing it up in abstract if you don't have it ready to go. You got to come with your receipts, right? You got to be ready to say, hold on, you say you didn't, but I have it right here. And also with someone like Green, who immediately, if you watch the clip, she starts gish galloping. She starts running through to Leslie. What about my school days? What about my speeding tickets, my parking tickets? She starts ranting. Are you going to ask me about everything I've ever done? That's the gish gallop there, right there. She's trying to overwhelm you with nonsense and distract you. What do you do in that case? You don't budge. So what I would have done is less is more. I'd have walked into that interview and said, do you believe Hillary Clinton skinned a young child and put her skin on her face, which is the frazzle drip conspiracy? A lot of people don't talk about this, Michael. It's called the frazzle drip conspiracy. It's one of the worst QAnon conspiracies. Marjorie Taylor Greene endorsed this. She can't say it was outsourced to a staffer. She endorsed this on Facebook before she was elected. She's never been asked about it by anyone, as far as I know. We checked, my team. Never seen her being asked about it. I would ask her about that, and I wouldn't move on. Oh, no, 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 no. I wouldn't go anywhere else. I would spend some time letting her burn in that scene. So hold on. She put the skin on her face? And where was Huma Abedin? She had a separate skin on her face? How does this work? That's what you do. You don't move on. We move on far too quickly in my industry, Michael. You got to stay put. Don't budge. And who knows where the rest of the interview goes, but I would take my time with Frazzle.
At that point, I guarantee you Marjorie Taylor Greene would not be tweeting out she had a wonderful time. Yeah. My man, Mehdi Hasan, oh my gosh, I knew I would enjoy this conversation.
Thank you. I loved it. Appreciate it, Michael.
I'm so excited about the book.
Thank you so much.
Win Every Argument, The Art of Debating, Persuading, and Public Speaking. Grab a copy. And learn how to have a different kind of conversation than the ones you're probably having right now, folks. And certainly you want to check out Mehdi as the host of the Mehdi Hasan show on MSNBC. And Mehdi, again, I just really appreciate you. I always have. I love when we get a chance to be on the air together, and it's just a lot of fun.
Thank you, Michael, and I appreciate it when I'm not on the air and you fill in for me. I appreciate that too, and so does my audience. So thank you for that.
All right, my friend. So appreciate Mehdi stopping by for the conversation. Folks, again, the book, Win Every Argument, The Art of Debating, Persuading, and Public Speaking. Check it out. Get a copy. Check out Mehdi as well on Twitter, at Mehdi. Mehdi Hasan.
It's R. Hasan.
Yep, Mehdi R. Hasan. I want to make sure you get the R in there. Check out his show, The Mehdi Hasan Show on MSNBC. Until next time, folks, be safe, be well, take care. Spring is in the air. The flowers are blooming. You know, the moments are just right to go outside and begin to enjoy what I think is going to be one hell of a hot summer, but we'll talk about that later. Until next time, Michael Steele Podcast coming at you.
Facepalm America is a show for progressives and others on the left who want to keep up with the ridiculousness that this country dishes out, find out what cable news misses when they're waiting for Trump to appear at a podium, and also, every once in a while, get a laugh at how silly this hot mess of a nation of ours really is. If that's you, listen to Facepalm America. You can go to facepalmamerica.com or find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.